and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the international response to Donald Trump's crass and contemptible speech before the UN and speak with the former New York Times bureau chief at the UN, Barbara Crissett, who is now the UN correspondent for The Nation. She joins us to describe how the representatives of the nations of the world reacted to the leader of the most powerful nation on earth threatening to destroy a country of 25 million people in what was a campaign-style speech meant to rile up Trump's base of, at best, 35% of the country, delivered on the world stage in the name of the 65% of Americans who are left to endure this embarrassment and insult to what Thomas Jefferson referred to as the good opinion of mankind. Then we'll go to Mexico City to get an update on rescue efforts underway following Tuesday's 7.1 magnitude earthquake 60 miles south of Mexico City that collapsed buildings and schools, resulting in a death toll of at least 250 so far, with many more trapped under the rubble. Dudley Althaus, a Wall Street Journal correspondent for Mexico and Central America, joins us to discuss how the earthquake coincided with earthquake drills on the anniversary of the deadly 1985 quake and the heart-wrenching search underway for school children buried under the rubble. Then finally, we'll examine the increasing focus on Facebook, the social media platform from which 67% of Americans get their news and information, that operates in total opacity as it boasts to advertisers of its powers to reach billions of users while refusing to be held accountable for its content, whether it is from, quote, Jew haters or Russian bots and trolls. David Carroll, a professor of media design at the Parsons School of Design, joins us to discuss his article at Medium, Confronting a Nightmare for Democracy, Personal Data, Personalized Media, and Weaponized Propaganda, and the risk of ceding our democracy to the dark databases and vast resources of plutocrats like the Mercers, who manipulate the public to increase their power over our political life and economic future. Joining us now is Barbara Crissett, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine, as well as the author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and later the New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Crissett.
Thank you.
And yesterday was quite an unusual day at the United Nations. And you were there, so give us a sense of what happened when Donald Trump made these extraordinary remarks that seemed out of place for a world body meant for nations to some extent, suppress their sovereignty and chauvinism and cooperate amongst them. It's about a family of nations, and yet here he is talking about sovereignty, which of course is code in dictatorships like in Russia and China, for don't question our human rights records, and says that we're America first and all of you should put your own priorities first. Well, that's obviously what happens at any rate, but you don't necessarily say that. But on top of that, it's threatening to destroy a country of 25 million people. That had to really rattle all of these countries. The idea that the most powerful nation on the earth could threaten to literally destroy a country at the United Nations. This goes beyond tone deafness. This was political vulgarity on a level beyond belief.
Yes, you asked what happened. What happened was dead silence in the hall. By the end of this, there was basically no applause. Trump marched out with his disciples, including Nikki Haley, the U.N. ambassador, and only Rex Tillerson stopped to shake hands with the Secretary General. People were already leaving the hall, although they'd been told to stay in their places until the president had departed. Some of them were leaving before he ever finished speaking. It was an extraordinary event, and certainly in the history of the United States at the United Nations, at least since the end of, you know, the end of the Cold War, but it goes back earlier than that. No one had put on a performance like this, which leads me to a secondary problem, which is just a kind of paraphrase here, that already the American media is taking this up as some kind of political story. This was a shock to the world, and that's really where some more attention should be focused. He scared an awful lot of countries. You said 25 million in North Korea, but how many million would be killed in South Korea? How many million American forces, troops, people on ships and so on, or even in Japan? I mean, no one knows what the reaction of Kim Jong-un would be if any kind of attack occurred, on him. So now they're the usual pundits, not the real experts, but some of the pundits saying, well, you know, he made his point. He was echoing George Bush. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm not a fan of George W. Bush, but this was unbelievably crude and unbelievably bombastic and actually terrifying. And it was done with that face he puts on when he wants to scare people. It was just appalling. There are no words beyond what I can think of now to talk about it. Add to this, he started his speech with a little, you know, sort of gentle hello and everything. But then he went into a detailed account of what terribly wonderful things he has done since he became a president, economy booming, all kinds of wonderful accomplishments, some of which were not true. A lot of what he claims in any case often is something that the seeds were planted in previous administrations, not just with Obama. But, you know, so no matter where you start on this, it was just, for an American, an embarrassing and almost physically sickening spectacle.
And again, I'm speaking with Barbara Crissett, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine, as well as the author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and later the New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations. Well, if he wanted to hurt Rocket Man, that's how he referred to the North Korean dictator, he certainly failed. I mean, I know the North Koreans walked out before the speech began, but any attention you give Kim Jong-un is a gift. That's what that regime relishes, the idea that this, you know, the tyranny of the weak, this pathetic, broken, lunatic country is getting so much attention on the world stage. That's what I see so much about this president, that he, or for all his macho bluster, he's the best ally the Russians ever had. He's the best ally the Chinese ever had. And if he doesn't start a nuclear war, he'll be the best allies that the North Korean have.
Yes, in fact, you mentioned China, and that's an important point, because a lot of people are speculating that when he was slapping around North Korea, this was also intended to be a message to China. You know, China is not North Korea. China is not a third world country anymore. China is an international figure, a power in economics, and in fact, in global climate change, it's all for the Paris Agreement. China has moved so far ahead, while Trump has moved the United States back. So if he thought that not only, you know, is he handing China, you know, sort of a gift by talking about it, not in this case, but maybe on other parts of the speech, he is also possibly irritating the Chinese. And I was just talking to a Japanese analyst who said that their intelligence says the Chinese are worried about Kim Jong-un because they don't know what he would do even to them. He can't obviously destroy China, but, you know, he can unleash refugees across the border. He can do a number of things. And what's happened is that over the last few years, or I don't know how many years now, Kim has methodically assassinated every possible person who was close to China. It started, you know, with his uncle of that generation. China now is scrambling to know where to get the best intelligence on North Korea. It sounds like, in many ways, the United States' problem. So, you know, no matter how you look at China, it was bad, by the time the thing was over, yesterday.
Well, the only way that this situation could be solved, I think, is for the Chinese to invade. And I don't know whether they could, and whether they have any intelligence assets left, because he killed the uncle, then he killed the older half-brother with using sarin gas, and he was under Chinese protection. So it's clear that Kim is more afraid of the Chinese than he is of the Americans. But clearly a collapse. The Chinese don't want the American army on the Yalu River again. So,
right.
I mean, I don't even know why we're talking about this, Barbara, because we have a president who has no concept of what we're discussing. Apparently, every day he yells at Mattis and all these generals because he wants to do something military. He wants to go to war against North Korea, and they keep saying we can't do anything. And he keeps hammering at them. So we have like a kindergarten kid having tantrums who is desperately and recklessly ignorant as our commander-in-chief and the president of the United States. I mean, anybody that normalizes this guy, I think, is, to say the least, unpatriotic.
Well, yes, it concerns me, as I said, that it's suddenly become a discussion about how he did, you know, what did this do for him politically here or not. And I think that, you know, that sort of misses the big picture quite obviously. But, you know, there's another major concern about his speech. His rant, apart from it sounding, it goes back to the kind of style of, you know, everybody, V.K. Menon, Fidel Castro, Gaddafi. I mean, that kind of hectoring. Someone did call it last night in a television news analysis more like a sermon than a speech. But he didn't offer any ideas. He blasted everybody and everything, including the U.N., He doesn't even understand how the UN works. I mean, he talks about they and us. They is us. I mean, you know, we are part of the UN and the most important country in it. But he doesn't offer any kind of, well, you explain why. He doesn't know anything about the world. You know, John Kerry was talking this morning on a talk show about how it took 35 years to get to the Iran deal. And if they want to walk away from that now, it's half a century when Iran can make nuclear weapons. I mean, I'm paraphrasing him. But, you know, he doesn't understand also the consequences of the things he says. Now, one of the most important initiatives that's not getting any attention in Washington is that the Russians and Chinese, whatever you divide it by how you believe them, have twice proposed, or three times in the Security Council, talks between among Russia, China, the U.S., South Korea, North Korea, you know, a sort of gang of four or five, to try to come up with, okay, if North Korea will freeze its development, you know, they don't have to throw all their weapons in the ocean. If they freeze their development, what would the U.S. give in return that Kim could accept, because he's a maniac also? And there are people well steeped in Korean-American relations over decades who believe that let's put this impossible thing on a table somewhere and see what. I mean, what would the U.S. say? Well, okay, we'll recognize North Korea. We'll send an ambassador. That's always been under the skin of Kim, that he hasn't got U.S. recognition. The U.S. will not give up supporting South Korea. That would be maybe the big stumbling block. But, you know, the fact that the Chinese and the Russians have had some ideas are just thrown out of hand by this administration, in part because they don't understand, as you say, the history, the knowledge of the region, and even the way you use the word tone, even the way you deal with Asian leaders, this is different. You're not talking to real estate developers or your base with their guns. You're talking to established Asian figures who can be very formal and have an entirely different approach to things. So he, and there are other areas, he didn't offer anything. It was a totally negative assault, with a few things thrown out that weren't true. The U.S. is a great, a great contributor to humanitarian. Yes, the refugee thing was a total lie because the U.S. has cut all the aid for, you know, maternal health and so on out of the budget, with the population fund gone in its in U.S. contributions, and so on and so on and so on. So they say the refugees will be happier where they are. We're going to help them reestablish. Well, they've cut the programs that would help them, or they want to cut. I think Congress will take that apart a bit. So, you know, in other words, where was the positive in this? And this is what people are searching for now, and it, I think it's, as you suggest, a waste of time.
Well, just in closing, Barbara Cassette, with this new axis of evil that Donald Trump has now enunciated, effectively North Korea, Venezuela, and Iran, again, what we're talking about in terms of North Korea relishing the attention they're getting from Trump, I imagine the same is happening with Maduro. The idea of an American military invasion of Venezuela is the most counterintuitive and counterproductive thing imaginable. And, of course, the Iranians today, the Rouhani, made a speech that was obviously contemptuous of Trump. And probably because of Trump's outrageous behavior yesterday, the world looks more kindly upon Iran.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. Yeah, a very interesting point. I don't want to go into, you know, a digression here, but it's a moment that some people now are beginning in Asia to say, are we seeing a new American policy? In Latin America, they're saying, oh my God, you know, here come the Yankees again. And it took several administrations to roll back some of that and improve relations with Latin American countries, all of, you know, many more of whom are democratic now than before. And along comes Trump and says these things about Venezuela, which, you know, which rightly will scare a lot of Latin Americans, but also, you know, gives the gift that you talked about earlier to the government of Maduro.
Well, Barbara Cassette, I thank you for joining us here today. I appreciate your time and the fact that you were able to witness this disgraceful behavior on the part of the President of the United States.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about it. and good luck with the rest of your coverage of this.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Barbara Cassette, who's a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine, as well as the author of several books on Asia. She was a New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and later the New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an update from Mexico City on the rescue efforts underway following Tuesday's 7.1 magnitude earthquake 60 miles south of Mexico City.
Come on now, who do you, who do you, who do you, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. You really think you're in control?
Somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México, 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 México.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Mexico City is Dudley Althouse, a Wall Street Journal correspondent for Mexico and Central America based in Mexico City. He has covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dudley Althouse.
Hi, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Dudley. I know you're very busy. The earthquake that struck on a Tuesday, 60 miles south of Mexico City, a 7.1 magnitude earthquake. At this point, the official toll is about, 250 people? But I'm hearing reports that this could be far, far greater. What are you hearing down there in Mexico City?
I'm pretty sure the toll is going to go up, but I mean, I don't know how great it's going to be. They've been digging for quite a while, and the rubble of buildings that collapsed, or something like 44 buildings that collapsed in Mexico City alone, plus the outlying states. But certainly there are people still trapped, dozens, scores, hundreds still trapped in the rubble. How many of those are dead and how many are still alive? It's hard to say.
And it's extraordinary. Somebody was quoted in Mexico City saying that we are cursed. I guess they're referring to the fact that the earthquake struck on the anniversary of the 1985 earthquake. I think people were actually doing earthquake drills in these schools, were they not?
They did earthquake drills commemorating the 1985 quake. They've done them every year, and they've done it at 11 o'clock in the morning, and this quake hit at 1:14 in the afternoon, just a little more than 2 hours later. The man quoted might have also been referring to the fact that this was the second quake, an 8.1 quake hit on September 7th, so the second quake in 12 days, and a time frame that also included three minor hurricanes that hit the Mexican coast. Mexico's had a rough couple weeks of it.
And how's the political authorities handling this, in particular Peña Nieto?
You know, I think the response so far has been very, very good. I mean, you know, very good might be a little much, but it's been very adequate. Peña Nieto was en route to southern Mexico where the quake struck on September 7th. To oversee recovery efforts there, and was about to land in southern Mexico on his jet when this quake hit. They immediately turned around. They didn't land and came back to Mexico City. He spoke to the nation several times on television yesterday. Late last night was the final time. He also went out and visited a school in southern Mexico City that had collapsed. One of the buildings had collapsed, killing several dozen young students and four teachers. And by young, I mean grade schoolers. And he went out there and he talked to family members and he was out there, which I think played pretty well with the public. Peña Nieto was not a particularly popular president. His approval ratings have been very low, even into the teens in recent months. But I think he... In my opinion, he's had a pretty good showing on this.
And U.S. President Donald Trump has been criticized in Mexico for taking a long time to contact Peña Nieto after the earlier quake that you mentioned earlier this month. He has stepped up now, but it's a very odd situation to have the former president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, almost on a kind of jihad against Trump. And I take it that Trump is not particularly popular in Mexico.
He's not a very popular guy here. I mean, his attacks on Mexico, even during the campaign, and Mexicans during his presidential campaign, and then, you know, going after canceling NAFTA, building a wall, going back and forth about the Dreamers, the DACA. He's not at all popular here. I think that a recent poll by the Pew, I think it was a Pew Heritage Trust, you know, it showed that public opinion here has gone dramatically against the United States, which most analysts read as going dramatically against Donald Trump.
And what would happen, do you think, if he does stick with the Attorney General Sessions, who wants to rescind DACA? There have been some talk of deals made with Chuck and Nancy, as Donald Trump refers to the Democratic leaders of the House and Senate. But it's still in flux. What would happen, do you think, if kids were sent back to Mexico, a country that they barely understand?
Well, you know, Mexico said they're going to welcome these kids back with open arms. We're talking about 600,000 kids or something like that. That's a whole lot of people to absorb here in a country that has a hard time getting jobs for its natural population growth as it is. Even these kids might be better educated and bilingual, many of them. So could have some, you know, value in the job market, which is, you know, export-oriented job sector of the job market. They could do that, but I think it's pretty, I think it would be a very big challenge for Mexico if these kids all of a sudden came back here. And they're not all kids. If these young people and young adults were forced back here. We've talked to many that have been coming back, like with parents that were deported and everything else, and they've had a lot of adjustment problems here. I mean, this is, as you said, a country they barely know. And had only heard about, many don't speak the language, don't really understand the culture. And I think they would have a hard time adjusting. Not everyone, but many.
Well, Pyongyang has referred to this second earthquake in 12 days as a new national emergency. Clearly, here in the United States, with repetitive hurricanes, there have been a series of national emergencies. And it's almost as if we're going to have compassion fatigue and donor fatigue. What's your sense of the response, the charitable response, if you will, from abroad to Mexico, given what's happening with hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and now Maria?
You know, I think actually Mexico has the resources to handle this on their own. They would certainly need the sympathy and perhaps help with some loans or that sort of thing. But, I mean, the Mexican state and the Mexican people really stepped up on this. They declared kind of a national emergency, which put the Army and the Navy in charge of the recovery efforts. And throughout Mexico City and the outlying states that have been damaged, you see tremendous efforts to, like, dig out the rubble of the collapsed buildings and rescue who they can. And they have been joined, these government people, so, you know, rescue crews and all the rest of it, have been joined by tens of many thousands of civilian volunteers in Mexico City and elsewhere that have just stepped up and started clearing out the rubble. Other people are bringing supplies, water, bringing hot meals to people working on the rubble. This happened in 1985, and it's happening again, and I think it's a very powerful testimony to what civil society has come to here. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know that Mexico needs that much outside help, per se, but they can certainly, I mean, if it's offered, they can certainly use it, I suppose.
And the descriptions of trying to get these children trapped under the rubble at the Enrique Rebsamen School are very, very heart-wrenching. You know, apparently there's lots, I don't know whether you've been there, Dudley, but you know, apparently they're continually telling everybody to be quiet, and they listen for the sounds of a couple of young schoolgirls between, I think, the ages of 6 and 12 trapped. Is this being covered, like, on a national TV?
It's being covered quite a bit here, and I've not been out to the site. We've had two reporters out at the site today. No, it's heart-wrenching stuff. These were young kids. These are grade schoolers. And the building just collapsed on them. So they're still in there. The rescuers are still after them. You know, Mexico has a core of specialists, an earthquake specialist, who go into the rubble and collapse buildings, that sort of thing, and rescue people, called the topos, which are, you know, the moles. They came into being during after the 1985 earthquake, and now go all over the world rescuing people in earthquakes. And they're at it here, and they're working around the clock. It's pretty amazing. But no, the school in itself is just heartbreaking.
And is the coverage, obviously, which is pretty intense, for example, transcending coverage yesterday, a lot of comments are happening here in the U.S. about Donald Trump's speech yesterday before the United Nations, which has shocked many people in this country. Any coverage down there? I mean, not that he's popular in the first place, but I think in terms of standing on the world stage and representing America, a lot of people were quite shocked. And I wondered if people in Mexico were also aware of what analysts are saying was one of the most unusual speeches in the history of the UN.
I didn't see the speech. I don't think many Mexicans saw the speech, and the earthquake news kind of pushed it out of the media. So I don't think, you know, frankly, I don't think people here are surprised by much of what the U.S. president says these days. They did, the newspapers and the television and radio did cover President Trump's well wishes to the people of Mexico City, for what that was worth.
But in general, the relations aren't very good. But the one thing I understand is pretty resolute on Mexico's part, and even on Peña Nieto's part, is that they are simply not going to pay for this wall.
Right. They will absolutely not pay for the wall. That's just not going to happen. That would, you know, they might as well just burn the Mexican flag and roll up the streets and head south. I mean, no, they're not going to pay for the new wall. You know, I think that's kind of a as somebody said about Canada and the NAFTA negotiations, that would be the hill that Mexico dies on.
Well, Dalia Altos, I thank you very much for joining us. I know you're very busy in Mexico City, and I appreciate your time.
Sure thing.
And again, I'm speaking with Dalia Altos, who's a Wall Street Journal correspondent for Mexico and Central America, based in Mexico City. He's covered everything from drug war mayhem and political intrigue to environmental threats and energy industry investment. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how much our democracy is being ceded to the dark databases and vast resources of plutocrats like the Mercers, who manipulate the public to increase their power over our political life and economic future. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Carroll, who is a professor of media design at the Parsons School of Design. He is also the director of its Design and Technology MFA program, exploring the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. His research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. He has an article at Medium, Confronting a Nightmare for Democracy, Personal Data, Personalized Media, and Weaponized Propaganda. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Carroll.
Thank you for having me on.
And thanks for joining us, David. And Democrats on Capitol Hill today have sent letters to the Federal Election Commission to get them to deal with future attacks on our elections by foreign actors, in particular Russia. Of course, there are no Republicans joining in, least of all the President of the United States, which is a peculiar silence from him about this attack on the very foundation of American democracy. But we just learned that via the New York Times that there was a FISA warrant issued to get these Facebook phony accounts where Russians posed as Americans. Recently, Facebook took credit, in effect, for revealing $100,000 worth of these accounts. But it seems like the real story is that there was a FISA warrant executed by the FBI, and special counsel actually had to go and pry this information loose from Facebook.
That's been my understanding, that the initial response from the company was to ironically protect the privacy of its customers, which is the people who pay for advertising on the platform. And it did take a legal response to get the information required to contribute toward the investigation, which would be not only the ads themselves, but also the targeting data, how they were targeted to people, and then any account information about the purchaser of that information. And all of that would be very useful forensics to the investigation.
So do you think that Mueller is going to be the first person? Obviously, it took a court order to get this information. Facebook has not been forthcoming with the Congress in their investigations, but it does seem like the special counsel has him in his crosshairs. Do you expect any move on the part of the government, assuming that something happens with this letter sent today by the Democrats to the Federal Election Commission, to force Facebook to be a better corporate citizen? Or do you think they will voluntarily make some cosmetic changes to head off any congressional mandates?
It seems to me that the company would be wise to adopt the same principles of disclosure and regulation of television political ads, meaning to require the disclosure of the purchaser of the ad in the ad itself. That would be the reasonable thing that the FEC would potentially require. Apparently, Facebook negotiated with the FEC very early on to exempt it from this requirement, and it was classified in the same category of political advertising as pencils and skywriting, meaning a format that you could not put the disclosure rules upon, and it was argued then that regulation would stifle innovation. Well, unfortunately, it did not stifle the innovation of foreign state actors to exploit the whole system and potentially target volatile propaganda messages at very susceptible voters in competitive districts where their vote counts much more than other Americans. So the concerns are very real here.
And again, I'm speaking with David Carroll, a professor of media design at the Parsons School of Design, where he explores the intersection between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. And he has an article at Medium, Confronting a Nightmare for Democracy, Personal Data, Personalized Media, and Weaponized Propaganda. So at the heart of looking into how Facebook was used, it seems to me that you have to go back to that moment during the presidential campaign when I don't remember what Republican sources were lobbying Facebook. It did seem fairly thinly sourced at the time. But the accusation was made that Facebook had a liberal bias and they got rid of the human curation of the news and then turned to algorithms. And they're very, very quickly thereafter, almost immediately thereafter, the Russians and Cambridge Analytica, owned by the reclusive billionaire computer scientist and mega donor to right-wing Republican causes, Robert Mercer and his daughter, seemed to get active. Is there any connection there? I mean, you've got a very prominent person who is an advisor to the Trump campaign, the second biggest shareholder in Facebook, Peter Thiel, clearly with a partisan interest. But what is the connection there between this Mau Mau attempt on the part of Republicans to get Facebook to sort of move the goalposts? It's an old tactic, but it does seem to have worked here.
So this is referring to the curation of the news headlines on somebody's Facebook page, and there were controversies about it, and it did force the company to rethink how it was going to curate them, and this is also related to the company's resistance of being considered a media company. It wants to be considered a technology platform so that it is not responsible with the same liabilities that a media company is. So it's not just the it's not just related to the concerns made by conservatives that the site was disseminating a bias, but it is also the company's own reluctance to hire editors and act like a media company, even though that's increasingly what it is doing. So it's a complicated set of issues here, and also the company makes its money by making advertising targeting available to anybody in the world with a credit card and providing very, very powerful tools to target Facebook users, even by name. If you have a list of personal information about people that you want to target on Facebook. So the questions about how the company decides what content appears in people's news feeds, the source for more than half of all Americans, where they get their news, the company is in a considerable sort of place of power and responsibility, and it is clearly struggling with that role, especially now in the context of not only political advertising, but potentially foreign propaganda. And the boundaries between these are very blurry. And it's important for the industry, journalists, academics, policymakers, et cetera, to untangle this.
Well, David Carroll, you just referred to an alarming statistic that the Pew Research Center just released in a study, that 67% of Americans get their news from Facebook and other social media platforms, mostly Facebook. So that in itself is an alarming statistic. And you cannot surely continue to be the piano player in the whorehouse and say, well, it's not my, I'm just a platform. I'm a passive, neutral platform. For example, YouTube has no pornography on it, whereas the internet is awash with pornography. So something is happening there. That's a Google company or Alphabet company. They appear to have some kind of algorithm that gets rid of pornography. So what is the problem here for Facebook saying that they can't somehow take responsibility for the enormous influence that they have in our political life?
Sure. So these companies actually do hire contractors called content moderators. And so humans are reviewing content constantly, things that are banned and flagged or detected by algorithms. So there really is a hidden labor force that is keeping these platforms adhering to their own policies. And this would probably be a very psychologically demanding job. And also the policies themselves, which have been leaked by outlets like The Guardian, allow us to see inside the company and to witness the often strange rationales for deciding what content should be allowable and what should be removed. So the company also has to abide by different rules, laws, and norms in different countries. So not only is it about its ability, for example, to keep pornography off of its platform, but also its ability to do specific things for specific countries, whether it be Saudi Arabia or China or other places. You know, for example, in Germany, in France, there is restrictions on referring to Nazis, and the companies do succeed at complying with those laws. So there's a relationship between the public outcry and holding the companies accountable to sort of the court of public opinion. And then there's also the role of regulations in each country to further enforce what needs to be enforced. So here in the U.S., we might be looking at disclosure rules around political ads. But the First Amendment will continue to be a very significant legal concept that will be negotiated here, as well as the Decency Act rules, which allow platforms to be considered a neutral conveyor of information and not responsible for what users post to the site. So from there, it's just their own corporate policies to decide. So it really is a private company's private interests here more than government regulation, at least in the United States.
But just a few days ago, ProPublica published an expose where they revealed a slew of hate charge and targeted categories that they put out to Facebook, Jew hater and how to burn Jews. And they essentially, the algorithms let it slip through. It's pretty provocative, I would think. Now, that's led to a little embarrassment on the part of Facebook. So what you just told us is certainly they're not very far along the path of reform if ProPublica was able to do this sting just a couple of days ago.
Indeed, journalists are playing a critical role in holding the companies accountable and looking for things such as the targeting, the abhorrent targeting capabilities of not just Facebook, but you know, other reporters found the same things on Google advertising products and Twitter advertising products. And in the case here, it was really humans who had hacked the system in the sense of regular Facebook users were allowed to put in their occupation a keyword that such as Jew hater, or and then that just field of information became a targeting option for advertisers. And so some of this is algorithms, but most of it is people making decisions about how these products should work and failing to moderate them so that things are discovered after the fact. So Facebook and these companies tend to operate on a sort of ask for forgiveness model rather than permission. And so when users are responsible for finding things and then flagging them, and that's when moderators then review them for to make a decision about them. So it's basically the model of how it works. So in that way, yeah, journalists play a crucial role in identifying these weaknesses, vulnerabilities, exploits, and publishing about them so that the companies can act. And in the case of Facebook, they removed the capability of targeting by that particular employment field. And so they solved that problem, but there are just many more problems just waiting to be discovered.
And again, I'm speaking with David Carroll, a professor of media design at the Parsons School of Design, where he explores the intersection between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. And he has an article at Medium, Confronting a Nightmare for Democracy, Personal Data, Personalized Media, and Weaponized Propaganda. Well, I think one of the big problems is that it does seem that Google, for example, uses these techniques with bots, etc., to pump up their advertising revenue. I think Procter & Gamble pulled $150 million worth of advertising because they discovered that the algorithms being used to exaggerate the extent of the effectiveness of buying their ads. And Twitter, of course, can be gamed through bots, and it is gamed through bots, not just Russian bot farms. So there seems to be that fundamental problem about the use of these kind of zombies that multiply people's messages on these social media platforms.
Yeah, this is a very significant issue that we are also starting to confront and struggle with. And this really does emerge out of the advertising industry, meaning for the past 10 years, as the digital advertising industry matured, it became plagued with bots that were fraudulently stealing ad dollars from advertisers and publishers alike. And this is a well-known problem within the industry, and some independent researchers have found examples of ad fraud networks that are capable of stealing thousands and thousands of dollars a day. And it's all happening behind the scenes. And there's a sort of continual cat and mouse game between companies trying to detect fraud and remove it from their networks while the fraudsters increase their sophistication and are earning billions of dollars a year out of the industry to fund their research and development. And one of the problems is that the fraud detection schemes are looking for traits of human behavior to distinguish between a machine and a real human being. So that creates the incentive for the fraudsters to create even more sophisticated ways to impersonate humans. And so when we ask, where did all these political bots come from, and how did this dark market of bot makers emerge? Where did this technology come from? Well, it came from digital advertising. And so the technology was there to create automated software that impersonates humans for political purposes. But it had originally come from defrauding the whole advertising industry. And the mechanisms to prevent it only made it more powerful. So we're dealing with the effects of the emergence of artificial intelligence here. You know, when machines start passing the Turing test, which is Alan Turing's famous and simple test, where if you are chatting with a machine and it passes as a human, where the human cannot tell if they're talking to a human or a machine, then we are starting to see the effects of artificial intelligence. And so this idea that a bot can be created for the express purpose of trying to get the president to retweet it, and that succeeds, and the president has allegedly retweeted bots on multiple occasions, we're seeing our own president take a Turing test in a way, and the machines are winning. So I think it is a general progress of technology, and these are some of the first downstream effects of artificial intelligence. And the challenge that the companies have here is that investors base their investment on user growth. So there's an economic incentive to allow the inflation of users to occur until really advertisers demand more accountability in terms of the accuracy of their
the data,
metrics.
Yes. So just in closing, though, David Carroll, I wanted to get back to the Mercers and the true, as you write in your article at Medium, Confronting a Nightmare for Democracy, Personal Data, Personalized Media, and Weaponized Propaganda, you say at the end of the article, we may never know the true scale of the Cambridge Analytica voter data and hyper-targeted media operation in the 2016 election. That also applies to the Russian interference. We presumably at some point or other, the special counsel and other investigations might well let us know the full scale of what appears to be a massive Russian intelligence operation against the last election in America. I don't know whether there's a connection there between the Russians and Mercer, but the one thing about Mercer is that he, along with the Koch brothers, almost single-handedly brought about Republican rule, or at least they're the beneficiaries of it. Mercer seems to be the number one character in terms of the, he's the number one investor in Donald Trump, and I'm sure he's getting his rewards. Bannon, of course, was the person he put in there along with Kellyanne Conway. Prior to that, he funded David Bossie, who wrote a, made a hit movie against Hillary Clinton. That became the basis of the Supreme Court case Citizens United. And obviously, Mercer has benefited from Citizens United, which now allows billionaires to buy our politics. And then, of course, he funded Bannon, who put together the, another hit job on Hillary Clinton called Clinton Cash. And he his company, as you mentioned in your article, had a big role in both Brexit in the elections, helping to elect Trump. And they also have a played a part in the contested elections in Kenya that are now having a redo because of chicanery and with Kenyatta's party, which involved Cambridge Analytica. So when are we going to get some real investigative journalism on the secretive company run by this secretive guy who has a disproportionate impact on our political life?
Yeah, this is a cause dear to my heart as well. As I mentioned in the article, we made an interesting discovery back in February and March when we requested our data from Cambridge Analytica. And remarkably, it came via London, which indicates that U.S. voter data is processed and stored in London, which would be an unprecedented condition. And interestingly, it then is subject to British law, the UK Data Protection Act in particular. And that was the reason why the company had to disclose the data. We don't have the equivalent law in the United States. If you ask a company for your data, they don't have to give it to you. Whereas if a company is registered with the regulator in the UK, the Information Commissioner's Office, then they are obliged to comply with the law, and that's why they did in this case. And indeed, the registered data controller of Cambridge Analytica is a company called SCL Elections. And in pursuing this, we have questions about whether or not the company has been compliant to British law, And Americans do not realize that the British regulator, the ICO, is investigating a British company's compliance to British law with regards to our election. The ICO is due to release a report on the voter analytics industry. So there will be new revelations, I suppose, connected to that. And indeed, the investigators in Washington, D.C. are interested in the company and its role. My understanding of what they probably did for the campaign, they initially worked for the Cruz campaign and then switched to the Trump campaign when the Mercers switched their support from Cruz over to Trump. And one basic thing they were able to do is to create very precise models of voters by combining our voter registration with commercial data available on the open market and kind of reattach our consumer behavior to our voter registration to predict things like how we will vote and what our personalities might be. And those lists then can be created and uploaded to Facebook so that voters can be targeted with very precise messages by name. And so the role of the company to legitimately and legally create these profiles and use Facebook to hyper-target them is something that needs to be further examined. In addition, the use of the personality modeling called psychometrics has been very controversial. Initially, the CEO, Alexander Nix, boasted of its ability to psychometrically model every U.S. voter. And then at a discussion panel, Matt Oskowski, the director of product, said that the company did not use psychometrics for the campaign. And then in August, the BBC ran a special where Alexander Nix was interviewed again, and he clarified after much pressing by the reporter that they used the legacy psychometrics from the Cruz campaign for the Trump campaign. So indeed, psychometrics was used, but psychometrics were not included in the data that I requested. So there are many, many unanswered questions. And even to the simple question of who were the recipients of the data, to sort of get to the transparency of, is it possible that a Russian company was a client of Cambridge Analytica? They refused to answer that question, even though we think that they are required to by law. So there are still lots of legal and regulatory investigations to pursue, and ironically, to pursue them in the UK, because that's where the company is based. That's where U.S. voter data is sitting, and that's where there is jurisdiction to get information from both regulators and potentially other kinds of lawsuits.
Well, David Carroll, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Carroll, who's a professor of media design at the Parsons School of Design. He explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. And he has an article at Medium, Confronting a Nightmare for Democracy, Personal Data, Personalized Media, and Weaponized Propaganda. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline reads